symbolize warmth and love, feeling and passion. They are qualities of the heart, found wherever human beings exist. In giving the Negro such a present, Henry symbolically combines a highly developed civilized product of his conscious ego with the center of his own primitivity and male strength, symbolized by the Negro. In this way, Henry can come into the full possession of his male sides, with which his ego must remain in constant touch from now on. This was the result. The six male persons, the four friends, the Negro and his servant, are now together in a gay spirit at a communal meal. It is clear that here Henry's masculine totality has been rounded out. His ego seems to have found the security it needs to enable him consciously and freely to submit to the greater archetypal personality within himself, which foreshadows the emergence of the self. What happened in the dream had its parallel also in Henry's waking life. Now he was sure of himself. Deciding quickly, he became serious about his engagement. Exactly 9 months after his analysis had begun, he married in a little church of western Switzerland, and he left the following day with his young wife for Canada to take up an appointment that he had received during the decisive weeks of his last dreams. Since then, he has been living an active, creative life as the head of a little family and holds an executive position in a great industry. Henry's case reveals, so to speak, an accelerated maturation to an independent and responsible manliness. It represents an initiation into the reality of outer life, a strengthening of the ego and of his masculinity, and with this a completion of the first half of the individuation process. The second half, which is the establishment of a right relationship between the ego and the self, still lies ahead of Henry in the second half of his life. Not every case runs such a successful and stirring course, and not every case can be handled in a similar way. On the contrary, every case is different. Not only do the young and the old, or the man and the woman, call for different treatment, so does every individual in all these categories. Even the same symbols require different interpretation in each case. I have selected this one because it represents an especially impressive example of the autonomy of the unconscious processes and shows by its abundance of images the untiring symbol-creating power of the psychic background. It proves that the self-regulating action of the psyche, when not disturbed by too much rational explanation or dissection, can support the development process of the soul. Photo captions. A 17th century engraving of the Palace of Dreams. Note, The Palace of Dreams, a 17th century illustration to Book 19 of Homer's Odyssey. In the center niche stands the goddess of sleep holding a bouquet of poppy flowers. On her left is the Gate of Horn, with the head of a horned ox above it. From this gate come true dreams. On her right, the Gate of Ivory, with an elephant's head above. From this gate come false dreams. Top left, the goddess of the moon, Diana. Top right, night, with the infants sleep and death. End of note. Left, the palace and monastery of Escorial, Spain, built by Philip II about 1563. Its fortress structure images the introvert's withdrawal from the world. Below, a drawing by Henry of a barn he built as a child with fortress-like battlements. One of Henry's childhood memories involved a crescent roll, which he drew, top left. Center, the same shape on a modern Swiss bakery sign. The crescent shape has long been linked with the moon, and thus with the feminine principle, as in the crown, left, of the goddess Ishtar of 3rd century B.C. Babylon. The initial stage of the process of individuation can sometimes be a period of disorientation, as was the case with Henry. Left, the first woodcut from the 15th century book The Dream of Polyphilo shows the dreamer fearfully entering a dark wood, perhaps representing his entrance into the unknown. Associations produced by Henry to his first dream. Right, Island of the Dead by the 19th century Swiss artist Arnold Böcklin. Far right, a scene from the 1944 London production of J.B. Priestley's They Came to a City, which concerns the reactions of a group of people from many walks of life to an ideal city. One of the central characters is a charwoman, left of picture. Left, the Greek maiden Danae, who was impregnated by Zeus in the form of a shower of gold, from a painting by the 16th century Flemish artist Jan Gossert. Like Henry's dream, this myth reflects the symbolism of the cloudburst as a sacred marriage between heaven and earth. In another of Henry's dreams, a doe appears, an image of shy femininity, as is the fawn in the painting, right, by the 19th century British artist Edwin Landseer. Left, Henry's drawing of the strange animals of his dream. They are mute and blind, unable to communicate, and so represent his unconscious state. The animal on the ground, which he colored green, the color of vegetation and nature, and, in folklore, a symbol of hope, hints at possibilities of growth and a chance of differentiation. The pig-like animal of the dream connotes bestiality and lustfulness, as in the myth of Circe, who turned men into swine. Above left, from a Greek vase, a pig man, Odysseus, and Circe. Right. In one of the cartoons by George Gross attacking pre-war German society, a man with a prostitute is given a pig's head to show his vulgarity. Left. Henry's drawing of the boat of his dream, with a stone wall for a railing. Another image of his introversion and fear of life. Right. The prehistoric sculpture known as the Venus of Willendorf, one of Henry's associations to the image of the prostitute in his dream. In the same dream, the saint is seen in a sacred cave. Many actual caves are holy places, like the cave of Bernadette, far right, at Lourdes, where a vision of the Virgin Mary appeared to a girl. A coat can often symbolize the outer mask or persona that one presents to the world. The mantle of the prophet Elijah bore a similar meaning. When he ascended to heaven, left, in a Swedish peasant painting, he left the mantle behind for his successor Elisha. Thus, the mantle represented the prophet's power and role to be assumed by his successor. In the painting, the mantle is red, like the saint's coat in Henry's dream. Henry's touching the prostitute can be related to the belief in the magical effect of a touch. Left, the 17th century Irishman Valentine Greatrakes, famous for healing by laying on of hands. Right, another example of the persona. The clothing worn by rebellious British beatnik youths in the 1960s indicated the values and way of life that they wanted to display to the outer world. As in the painting Left by the 19th century British artist William Turner, entitled Rain, Steam, and Speed, the locomotive is clearly an image of driving dynamic energy. In Henry's dream, which he drew below, locomotives are raised out of a lake, an expression of the release of a potential for valuable action that had previously been repressed into his unconscious. Left, two pages of the I Ching showing the hexagram Meng, which stands for youthful folly. The top three lines of the hexagram symbolize a mountain and can also represent a gate. The bottom three lines symbolize water and the abyss. Right, Henry's drawing of the sword and helmet that appeared to him in a fantasy and that also related to a section of the I Ching, Li, the clinging, fire. Right, a parallel to the gatekeepers of Henry's oracle dream, one of a pair of sculptures, 10th to 13th century, that guard the entrance to China's Mai Ji San caves. Below, a drawing by a patient under analysis depicts a black monster on the red or feeling side and a Madonna-like woman on the blue or spiritual side. This was Henry's position, overemphasis on purity, chastity, etc., and fear of the irrational unconscious. But note that the green mandala-like flower acts as a link between the opposing sides. Below left, another patient's painting depicting his insomnia, caused by his repressing too strongly his passionate red instinctual drives, which may overwhelm his consciousness, by a black wall of anxiety and depression. Above, an Egyptian relief, about 1300 BC, shows a scarab beetle and the god Amun within the circle of the sun. In Egypt, the golden scarab was itself the symbol of the sun. Below, a quite different kind of insect, more like the devilish beetles of Henry's Dream, an engraving by the 19th century artist James Ensor of humans with dark, repulsive insect bodies. Above, a phoenix reborn in flames from a medieval Arabic manuscript, a well-known example of the motif of death and rebirth by fire. Below, a woodcut by the 19th century French artist Granville reflects some of the symbolic value of playing cards. The spade suit, for instance, in French pique, is symbolically linked with the penetrating intellect and, by its black color, with death. A drinking vessel from ancient Peru in the shape of a woman reflects the feminine symbolism of such containers, which occurs in Henry's final dream. In Psychology and Alchemy, Dr. Jung discusses a sequence of over 1,000 dreams produced by one man. The sequence revealed a striking number and variety of representations of the mandala motif, which is so often linked with the realization of the self. See Part 3. These pages present a few examples of mandala imagery from the dreams to indicate the vastly different forms in which this archetype can manifest itself, even in one individual's unconscious. The interpretative meanings offered here may, because of their brevity, seem to be arbitrary assertions. In practice, no Jungian would produce an interpretation of a dream without knowledge of the dreamer and careful study of his associations to the dream. These interpretative statements must be taken as hints toward possible meanings, nothing more. Left. In the dream, the anima accuses the man of being inattentive to her. A clock says 5 minutes to the hour. The man is being pestered by his unconscious. The tension thus created is heightened by the clock, by waiting for something to happen in 5 minutes. Below. A skull, which the man tries in vain to kick away, becomes a red ball, then a woman's head. Here the man may try to reject the unconscious, kicking the skull, but it asserts itself by means of the ball, perhaps alluding to the sun and the anima figure. Left. In part of a dream, a prince places a diamond ring on the fourth finger of the dreamer's left hand. The ring, worn like a wedding ring, indicates that the dreamer has taken a vow to the self. Below left, a veiled woman uncovers her face, which shines like the sun. The image implies an illumination of the unconscious, involving the anima, quite different from conscious elucidation. Below, from a transparent sphere containing small spheres, a green plant grows. The sphere symbolizes unity. The plant, life and growth. Below, troops, no longer preparing for war, form an 8-rayed star and rotate to the left. This image perhaps indicates that some inner conflict has given way to harmony. End of photo captions. Conclusion. M. L. von Franz. Science and the Unconscious. In the preceding chapters, C. G. Jung and some of his associates have tried to make clear the role played by the symbol-creating function in man's unconscious psyche and to point out some fields of application in this newly discovered area of life. We are still far from understanding the unconscious or the archetypes, those dynamic nuclei of the psyche, in all their implications. All we can see now is that the archetypes have an enormous impact on the individual, forming his emotions and his ethical and mental outlook, influencing his relationships with others, and thus affecting his whole destiny. We can also see that the arrangement of archetypal symbols follows a pattern of wholeness in the individual, and that an appropriate understanding of the symbols can have a healing effect. And we can see that the archetypes can act as creative or destructive forces in our mind, creative when they inspire new ideas, destructive when these same ideas stiffen into conscious prejudices that inhibit further discoveries. Jung has shown in his chapter how subtle and differentiated all attempts at interpretation must be in order not to weaken the specific individual and cultural values of archetypal ideas and symbols by leveling them out, that is, by giving them a stereotyped, intellectually formulated meaning. Jung himself dedicated his entire life to such investigations and interpretative work. Naturally, this book sketches only an infinitesimal part of his vast contribution to this new field of psychological discovery. He was a pioneer and remained fully aware that an enormous number of further questions remained unanswered and call for further investigation. This is why his concepts and hypotheses are conceived on as wide a basis as possible, without making them too vague and all-embracing, and why his views form a so-called open system that does not close the door against possible new discoveries. To Jung, his concepts were mere tools or heuristic hypotheses that might help us to explore the vast new area of reality opened up by the discovery of the unconscious, a discovery that has not merely widened our whole view of the world, but has in fact doubled it. We must always ask now whether a mental phenomenon is conscious or unconscious, and also whether a real outer phenomenon is perceived by conscious or unconscious means. The powerful forces of the unconscious most certainly appear not only in clinical material, but also in the mythological, religious, artistic, and all the other cultural activities by which man expresses himself. Obviously, if all men have common inherited patterns of emotional and mental behavior, which Jung called the archetypes, it is only to be expected that we shall find their products, symbolic fantasies, thoughts, and actions, in practically every field of human activity. Important modern investigations of many of these fields have been deeply influenced by Jung's work. For instance, this influence can be seen in the study of literature, in such books as J.B. Priestley's Literature and Western Man, Gottfried Diener's Faust's Weg zu Helena, or James Kirsch's Shakespeare's Hamlet. Similarly, Jungian psychology has contributed to the study of art, as in the writings of Herbert Reed or of Aniela Jaffe, Erich Neumann's examination of Henry Moore, or Michael Tippett's studies in music. Arnold Toynbee's work on history and Paul Radin's on anthropology have benefited from Jung's teachings, as have the contributions to sinology made by Richard Wilhelm, Enwin Roussel, and Manfred Porkert. Of course, this does not mean that the special features of art and literature, including their interpretations, can be understood only from their archetypal foundation. These fields all have their own laws of activity. Like all really creative achievements, they cannot ultimately be rationally explained. But within their areas of action, one can recognize the archetypal patterns as a dynamic background activity. And one can often decipher in them, as in dreams, the message of some seemingly purposive evolutionary tendency of the unconscious. The fruitfulness of Jung's ideas is more immediately understandable within the area of the cultural activities of man.